From John's Gospel, chapter 20. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Saying this, she turned round and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom do you seek?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary, Mary." And she got it. She got the message. Our opening hymn here and opening hymns on Easter morning in most churches put to music the sentiment, "Jesus Christ is risen today." And that's not quite true. Jesus Christ was risen from the dead on a particular day some time back. The story is accounted in the New Testament in several different ways, the most poignant of which is the one-on-one resurrection appearance where Jesus comes forth from the tomb and surprises Mary Magdalene in a way that she could not have imagined was possible, that he was alive. I don't know this to be the case, but I've always imagined that in the run-up to the plan on Jesus coming to earth and going from Bethlehem to Calvary, that the payoff that Jesus and his Father worked out in advance, okay, we'll do this and we'll save the world, but I want a minute with Mary when it's over, fair enough, so that she knows and spreads the word. Jesus Christ is risen then. But how do we know he's risen again today in reality? You ever have a conversation with somebody, and when you part company, you're thinking to yourself, you know what? That person just flat out doesn't get it. And maybe they never will. Well, getting it happens from time to time. And I think that's in part evidence of the spirit of the resurrection. I have about 250 students this semester, one of whom is right over there. And one of the singularly most important thing we try to teach is that there are varieties of ways to look at the same thing. And when someone puts a position forward, be able to analyze and understand the strengths and limits of that point of view over and against the strengths and limits of another, and be able to see what point of view they're using to make their case. That's kind of the high water mark of first and second year instruction. The next level, I have a junior and senior class where I ask them to frame a research question and then to go into the literature and find out what others have said that's relative to that concern. And invariably, half of them will say to me at one point, "I just can't find anybody that's answered my question." I'm going, "Good. Now you go answer it." But the most difficult thing is to take someone else's work and apply the logic of that to your own question. And most people don't get it, at least until they get to the graduate level. To be able to take the logic of someone else's thinking, even though they weren't thinking about stuff you care about, and apply the logic of it to what you do care about, that's called scholarship. I had a conversation with a first-year grad student a month or so ago, and she was laying out some of the ideas she had about doing a master's thesis. And just between you and me and anybody that listens to this on the internet, she was all over the map. And so I had to sort of say, you know, a master's thesis is one that's doable, and you've got a million different things and threads that we need to sort of wrap into some kind of coherent logic. And I gave her some people to read and some things to look at and a couple of different suggestions on how to begin to focus her thinking. And just this last week, she came in rather unexpectedly to my office and said, "You know, I read this one particular piece you suggested, and all of a sudden I decided to do this." And she got it. Go on. He is risen. He is risen today. When you get it, that's the issue. That's the thing. And that's just one way of exploring how we get it from time to time. Whatever it is, and however you get it, that's the evidence that he is risen. He's risen today. Not the only way. At my alumni magazine from the University of Wisconsin a week or so ago, the University of Wisconsin is a wonderful place. Well-regarded school, has a good reputation. It also is on the top five every year on the list of party schools. Maybe that's why there's an educational psychologist up there on the faculty that has spent his entire life researching the concept of forgiveness. I guess maybe we need it up there more than other places. Big secular school. And an educational psychologist named Robert Enright, who writes about forgiveness as a source of personal peace. And this is just a synopsis of some of the things that he's done over a career of researching this question. But he makes the argument, and I think it's compelling and partially persuasive, that forgiveness is an achievable virtue. This is a skill we can practice and begin to implement it. He calls it becoming forgivingly fit. And in some sense, using the moving through and past some of the petty grudges that we have to getting to the really big ones. And he's even counseled and schooled other scholars and folks how to deal with terrible things that have happened to them in the course of growing up and so on. But he talks about it as a process. Coming to terms with what you're angry about and uncovering it, and being quite honest about it, for example. For example, how have you avoided dealing with your anger toward some other person or some other set of concerns? Are you afraid to expose your own shame or guilt? Has the injury changed your worldview? Just a couple of beginning points of departure. And then secondly, making a conscious decision to forgive. Decide that what you've been doing hasn't worked. You know, if you keep doing the same thing over and over and expect the outcome to be different, well, Albert Einstein defined that as insanity. And grudges and resentments can make us crazy, can't they? Decide, he says, to forgive. Work on it. Accept the pain that goes with this. And this is among the most interesting suggestions he has. Give the offender a gift. A gift. A merciful act. A smile. A phone call. Or, if nothing else, a prayer. You know, just between you and me, it's really hard to truly despise someone that you include in your prayers. It's an achievable virtue through a conscious decision. And then discover the freedom of forgiveness. Discover the freedom of forgiveness. Well, you and I have people that we're lucky enough to have in our lives that love us mostly anyway. And we have hurt them over the years. And when, after having done that, you sort of come to a mutual decision that I'm just tired of being mad anymore and you're still worth it, and you take a breath and you walk one step more, he is risen. He is risen today. When someone does that for you or you with someone else, a little bit more of the evidence that the resurrection is real. When you get it, when you get forgiven. And sometimes, thirdly, it requires what Jesus suggested in the New Testament, that you become as a little child in order to fully understand the meaning of the resurrection today. We have a 7-year-old granddaughter who lives in Illinois and is one of these people that's just goofy for bugs. She just loves bugs. And that's kind of cool in and of itself. But this is probably the third year where, right about this time of year, they make a little pilgrimage to, you know, across the way, and there's a park close by their home that has, among other things in it, proliferation of milkweed pods. Well, at this time of the year, starting about now, underneath a milkweed leaf, you can often as not find what looks like a little black and yellow caterpillar. And Katie loves to catch these caterpillars, which aren't that hard to do. And of course, you get milkweed leaves along with them and maybe a stick, and you put them in a nice big jar, and you watch the caterpillar sort of enjoy this restaurant you've created of milkweed leaves on which they are ravenously feeding until, unless you sort of know the end of the story, the caterpillar essentially dies and creates for itself a kind of tomb that just sits there for a while until, and the 7-year-old will tell you exactly when this happens because they never stop watching it, until, of course, the cocoon opens and a monarch butterfly comes forward. Well, when you catch the spirit of a 7-year-old who witnesses an event like that, now you not only know that he's risen, but you know he's risen today. And now in the spirit of graduate education, apply the logic of that metaphor, a 7-year-old and a cocoon and a butterfly, to your own life and experience. And you take it wherever it is that makes sense to you. And you will know that he's risen. He's risen today. Well, we celebrate Easter Sunday once a year. But I will tell you that liturgically, every Sunday is an anniversary of Easter. And in fact, the 6 or 7 Sundays that occur during the season of Lent don't count as days in Lent. So if you give up something for Lent, each of the Sundays up until Easter, you get a pass. I know, now I tell you, right? Each Sunday is an anniversary of Easter, and each Sunday is an opportunity to get it, to feel it, and to apply the metaphor that he's risen today. I'm going to tell you how I've been able to do that personally, pretty much every Sunday for about the last 4 years. And it's an odd metaphor, again, that you'll have to take and apply to your own experience. The architecture of the Christian church, where we have worship at 9 o'clock, is kind of interesting. You know, the altar looks pretty much right about where it is, but behind the altar, there are 3 chairs, and the elders and I sit right here. And in fact, I have the middle chair. That's my spot. Well, it turns out that on the altar, right in front of me, directly at eye level, is a brass polished cross. And when I sit where I'm supposed to sit, when I occupy my spot and look straight ahead, I see myself reflected in the cross. That's the image, that's the metaphor. How are we reflected in the cross? Well, I think we're reflected in the cross every time we understand or apply a new insight, every time we feel a sense of being forgiven, every time we catch the spirit of a 7-year-old, but also when we prevail and persevere over difficulty and hardship, when in any way it falls to us to be a witness to others on how to prevail and persevere in hardship. But now let me ask you one more question. The forgiveness guy at the University of Wisconsin, he actually lays out, and imagine to yourself, who is it you think that's the hardest person in your life to forgive? Who is it? It's yourself. Because no one knows any better than we our failings and faults, some of which we keep pretty closely hidden. But imagine that unforgivable part of you reflected in the cross, and understand that this was how far God went for you, to take a couple of pieces of wood that was essentially an execution machine and create for us an image of highly polished brass and a picture of a loving reflection of you in the cross. And then you know and can carry forward the reality that he is risen. He's risen today. He's risen today for you. Amen.